This is the Political History of Apollo, a limited series podcast from the Planetary Society exploring the reasons why the United States decided to send humans to the moon and why the nation pulled back after landing only 6 times. I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's chief advocate and senior space policy advisor. I'm going to be joined by some of the world's leading experts in space policy and history in interviews originally broadcast as part of our monthly show, Planetary Radio Space Policy Edition. We grouped these interviews together in an attempt to tell a fuller story about Project Apollo, to get beyond the flags and footprints we so often see, and look at the deeper issues, like the political prehistory of the space age, the Cold War, the political opposition and cultural impacts to the nation, and even look at the Soviet side of the space race to the moon. The show is a production of the Planetary Society, a nonprofit dedicated to space science and exploration. So if you like what you hear, please consider joining or donating at planetary.org/membership. This is Episode 5, Apollo as a Gift or a Curse. For this episode, I wanted to step back and look at the totality of the issues we've discussed, reference back to the original interviews that I've had with our experts, but also have a conversation with my colleague, Matt Kaplan, who is going to join me today, to really look back and say, what can we take from Apollo, if anything, and what does it mean for us as we move forward today, whether or not it's as we record this or going into the future, as human exploration once again turns its eyes beyond the Earth. Matt Kaplan, the producer and host of Planetary Radio, joins me right now. Matt, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, Casey, and it has been a pleasure to work with you on this this limited series, which has taught me a lot and also reminded me of the exciting period that, unlike you, I was lucky enough to live through.
Yes, you remember that. And if you can't already tell, this is going to be a more casual and extemporaneous discussion compared to some of our previous episodes. But I think it's going to be important. You'll hear us both try to work through this as well. And I think the essence of this episode, if I can give it away a little bit, is that there's no clear answer to this. Maybe that's going to be disappointing. But it's worth trying to process together. So, Matt, I'm happy to have you on, and kind of fun to have this role reversal. I'm not used to introducing you.
It's gotten to be fun for me. It used to be more disturbing, but now I kind of enjoy it because people who interview me get to squirm the way I do when I do these. So have fun, Casey.
I won't go through your long and illustrious CV. Well, let me start with something because, again, just looking back, Matt, you were listening very closely and part of all those interviews that I did for this show and for the Space Policy Edition. You've been thinking about these issues for a long time now. As you said, you were alive to experience Apollo as it happened. Large part of our audience is, but a large part of our audience wasn't. And so how has Apollo changed for you, your understanding of it as you have gone through life? Have you had an evolving appreciation for it, or have you always kind of remained this childhood experiential aspect of it? Has that remained in the forefront?
I've been able to retain that childlike wonder and fascination, which probably people hear as I host this this show, the weekly version of Planetary Radio. But it has been so rewarding in many ways to learn that the story is so much deeper. I want to give you an analogy. Minutes before we started recording, I was downstairs on the treadmill watching a new documentary from American Experience about Woodstock, about the coming together of this 3 days of peace and music, which, of course, was happening right in the smack dab in the middle of Apollo. The concert was, you know, like a month and a half after, or a month after, Neil and Buzz walked on the moon. Very much like my understanding of Apollo at the time and for years since, there was so much more going on behind the scenes to pull those 3 days of what seemed like just hippie peace and love together to make it happen because of the infrastructure that it took and the politics that went into it and the policy decisions, if only on a local level in upstate New York. It's a fascinating story. I do see parallels to what you and your guests were able to reveal over the four episodes of this series about Apollo. There is far more to think about and far more to understand about what was going on in American society through those years. Not all of it was peace and exploration and feeling simply jubilant that we had people walking on the moon. There was that, of course, and that seems to be the dominant memory that we are left with. But there was so much more of it going on at the time, as your guess so ably demonstrated.
Something I have kept in my head, and this would be interesting to try to prove in some way, looking back, particularly as we record this is the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, to be alive and still be alive today, 50 years later, for Apollo history, you probably weren't voting at the time, right? So the majority of what I'm trying to say, the majority of living memory of Apollo now is very likely perceived from a childhood memory versus an adult memory. I wonder if that played into this idea of Apollo changing over time into being, we discussed this in episode 3 and a little bit in episode 4, this public hesitation about whether it was worth it or not, or the overall value of the space program, and how that's grown over time. In fact, the more distant we've become from Apollo, the more popular it has become. Lacking that kind of adult engagement with it, of voting, politics, priorities, social responsibility or civic responsibility, and just being able to enjoy it as this almost kind of purity of exploration, seeing basically the surface level expression of Apollo, which was the video, you know, the TV broadcast of Neil and Buzz on the moon. That's kind of this working theory I have, that it's almost turning into a myth as we're watching it. That's interesting, you know, to watch in a lot of ways, right? We're seeing it become internalized into the self-identity of not just Americans, but also a worldwide human culture. But as it does so, as something turns into myth, the complications and the oppositions and the hesitations that all were around when it happened disappear. I worry ultimately, and this is one of my goals of this show, was that we can't forget that Apollo was an unlikely event that almost didn't happen, and people tried to prevent it from happening at multiple points. And so that's what I kind of see is like kind of looking back, you know, to take it to your analogy with Woodstock, where at the time you had cities trying to block the occurrence of that festival. And so they had to scramble at kind of on their feet. They gave up from trying to make money, and they just had a thing, but it also kind of became immortalized from the memory of the people who were there into this broader consciousness. And all the complexity of putting it on, not to mention ever recreating it, right, of the attempted Woodstock 94, 99, and then nothing else, reminds you that it may have been almost an accident of history rather than some inevitability.
You're taking my analogy even further, and I think it's very fitting. It makes one wonder. I bet you that there are a number of people, as I know there are regarding Woodstock, who claim to have been there. And if everybody who claims to have been at Woodstock was actually there, it probably would have been a concert of about 10 million instead of half a million. I wonder if the same is true for Apollo. I also wonder if the way we feel, have come to feel about Apollo, all good, almost saintly, will go through yet another transformation based on the times. Just as, you know, JFK, who was a controversial president at the time that he was president, he sort of attained sainthood, deservedly or not. And it's only in more recent years that we've learned more about him and that, you know, he was just a human being like the rest of us. You're right. Apollo, particularly, I guess, now with this 50th anniversary, seems to be going through something of a renaissance, which can probably at least partly be seen in the plans for Artemis to return humans to the moon. But I certainly hope that it will always be set apart from these other examples that we've given, because it represents such a genuine achievement by humanity and something that humans had dreamt of for as long as I suspect there have been humans.
Right. And I didn't say this at first. I'm quoting, but I'm forgetting who first said it. It's almost certain that of any one thing that will ever be remembered from the 20th century, it will be Apollo. That event, it would be hard to say what will be remembered in the future based on this time. Mm-hmm. But you can almost guarantee that Apollo will be because of that very essence that you just pointed out, that it satisfied this primordial urge almost of all mammals to say, what's this big glowing orb in the sky? And particularly humans, which have this quirk of evolution to say, well, let's go there, you know, set sail on this. Well, I hope I won't die while I go there. Of all the complications and the imperfections of the political process that brings you this event, can you ultimately, or should we ultimately, separate that out from the event itself, right? If you can just enjoy the event as this expression of exploration and excitement and of adventure, and realize that this success of it will echo through centuries, if not millennia, of human future human history, that is an astonishing achievement for no other reason but that. At the same time, maybe when we try to apply it then to more prosaic current events, that mode of thinking about Apollo doesn't work anymore. It's important to think about that big picture purity from a mythos-making, epical, experiential mode, historical mode, but it's not the useful way potentially to think about Apollo from a practical mode of how we can do something like that again.
I agree with you. And I would say that understanding the underpinnings of Apollo and its times have deepened my appreciation for what was accomplished. And certainly, one would hope, are teaching us lessons for what we should be aware of as anything at almost any scale, and certainly the grand scale of putting humans on the moon, would be attempted again. And I know that's some of what you want to address in this conversation and what you've addressed already.
I have a list of things that are my takeaways from this series of doing this series of interviews. But I have one more question for you first, Matt. As again, going back to this idea that you lived through not just Apollo, but of course the intervening time between Apollo and now, have you been disappointed in a way? Did you feel you were sold a false bill of goods in terms of expectations? How have you,
sure.
I mean, and I know you're actually one of the most optimistic and genuinely positive people I've met. But at the same time, you know, your relationship with human spaceflight, we're saying, you mentioned Artemis, this is the third time a president has said we've been going back to the moon in the last 50 years after Apollo. How do you see that and not just say, you know, of course, this is just words again. How does that relationship change over time based on what you've seen? And then also given the fact that you started with this immense success.
And it wasn't even my start. It was more evidence of where I hoped and believed and even prayed we were going. Because I'd been following the space program since being a little kid and was still, you know, an early teenager when Apollo 11 happened. The year before, when 2001 A Space Odyssey was released, that's what I wanted to do for my birthday, I told my parents. And sure enough, they took me to see 2001. And I can tell you, I was blown away, not just by, you know, the trip portion at the end, but even more so for me, the early part, showing a great double-ringed space station in orbit and a space shuttle and a ferry taking people back and forth to the moon and this grand base, this establishment on the moon, Clavius Base. And it all seemed perfectly logical to me. It all seemed like, yes, this is the direction we're going in. 2001 sounds about right. And Apollo 11 seemed like, yeah, it's a baby step, but it's a really big step, one might say a giant leap for mankind, in that direction. And it wasn't until a year or two later, remember I was still pretty young, that I started to realize we're not going there. We're not going there at anywhere near the rate that it's going to take to achieve these things. And yeah, that was a downer, as we said in the 60s. But fortunately, I learned about other things that were going on in space exploration and space development. And I was able to pin my hopes on a lot of those. Many of those didn't pan out the way we had originally hoped either. The space shuttle, the space station, Freedom. But certainly there were enough successes, and the grand successes that we saw and continue to see in planetary science were enough to keep me hopeful. But no, are we where I thought we would be when I watched Neil and Buzz walk around on the surface in black and white? Not a chance.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think drives a certain set of cynicism, particularly within people who follow space very closely. I almost ascribe it to that moment of being alive for Apollo and then seeing that future that was promised, and not just from 2001, A Space Odyssey, but the whole, as we discussed with Roger Lanius, the whole lead up to Apollo and why it even became this option to demonstrate U.S. capability in space was decades in the making. It was a cultural effort first to establish space flight as this, not just a realistic possibility, but almost this inevitability, the final frontier, right?
Exactly.
The next steps of human evolution, which was so beautifully captured in 2001, A Space Odyssey, is that it wasn't just a place to go. It represented this metaphorical, and in 2001 cases, a literal transfiguration of the human state into something new, this mm-hmm. next level of evolution. And instead, we found that space was resolutely uncooperative with us. And it was always harder than we thought. And it was just, it did not and does not give up its secrets easily, nor does it really tolerate our presence in it very well. Or maybe we should flip it around and say, we don't tolerate being in space particularly well either. I grew up in the 80s, and I grew up with the space shuttle as just being there and not having that expectation that we'd be going anywhere else with people. But when I was a kid, I pored over books of Voyager and Pioneer and Magellan and Viking. Those were the missions that felt to me like the exploration, that this were these next steps, and that we could only build a robot to go to Neptune or to Pluto. The idea of humans being the ones to go even beyond the moon wasn't really there, because we'd established this modus operandi of the space shuttle, like, oh yeah, humans will float around in orbit. But that never captured my expectation in the same way. This is why we titled this episode a little cheekily, The Gift or Curse of Apollo. But we heard Asif Siddiqui in episode 2 talk about Apollo almost as a curse to NASA, that it set the expectations so profoundly high. And NASA was able to deliver that because it didn't have the resources to continue that rate of progress, anything that they would do specifically with humans in space would forever seem like a fallback, a step down from what was possible. But if Apollo had never happened, if we had originally gone with more of an Eisenhower approach to space, with suborbital, orbital flights, maybe a space station, maybe a reusable rocket first, and then lots of scientific missions robotically, our expectations wouldn't have been set in that same way. Of course, we wouldn't have gone to the moon. That takes so much work and money. It's not very practical. And we wouldn't necessarily have this concept of disappointment. And so that's what I wonder in terms of how much has NASA still had to live under the shadow of that incredible success through no fault of their own, and how much of the public's expectation after Apollo, without understanding the details and the politics and the resources that were put into it, to say, why can't we just go to the moon? You know, that classic saying, right? We can put a man on the moon, but we can't, you know,
put a man on the moon.
Yeah. Or go to Mars and so forth. So how have you interacted with that shadow of Apollo in your expectations? How have you modulated your expectations over the years?
Damn NASA for setting our expectations so high, for making it look easy until you look under the hood. You could make the case, I suspect, and this is based largely on what I have learned in these conversations that you've had, that we've actually made pretty good progress. When you look at the fact that, because it sounded like I was putting down the space station and the shuttle, I'm not. I'm in awe of these accomplishments. When you look at the fact that we have learned with great effort to live in space, to have humans living in vacuum for 20 continuous years and meet and surpass, surmount nearly all of the challenges that that entails. To have learned what we learned by building the space shuttle and flying it for a similar amount of time, in spite of the cultural and political and economic challenges to make anything at all happen, perhaps we should all be thankful that we have achieved what we have. And I suspect if it had not been for the success of Apollo, all of these things that have followed would have been in great jeopardy. You know, I think of what might have happened if what happened to the Soviet N1, if you'd reverse the roles and that had been the Saturn V and the N1 had been a success and the Soviets had gone to the moon ahead of the United States, who knows what would have happened? Would we have had an international space station and a space transportation system and the other successes we've seen? No one can say, but I'm more satisfied with our progress as I have learned more, actually, in spite of my disappointment that we don't have a giant base in Clavius Crater.
Carl Sagan's attitude from his wonderful essay that we posted online that he wrote originally for the 25th anniversary of Apollo, he basically characterized that as the gift of Apollo, that even though we haven't gone back to the moon with humans, the infrastructure, the expectations, even though it was unmet, that the resources couldn't match it, they still were probably better than what they would have been had it not happened. And his interpretation is that same idea. We had the space shuttle, the space station, but also, of course, these robotic probes, Viking, the Mariners, Cassini, Voyagers, Pioneers, you name them, themselves as a consequence. That was the gift of Apollo, that we had this capability, expertise, and the quote-unquote cheaper option was to shift to robotic probes, particularly in the 1970s. That was a conscious policy choice made by the Nixon administration and then followed up by Carter, was to invest in these robotic missions. And right after Apollo ended, even though NASA's budget went down, you saw the biggest investment in planetary science robotic missions up until very recent history. Viking, I think, is still the most expensive planetary science mission. It was really four missions ever attempted. Hmm. I think that's a more positive way to look at it, and as opposed to a curse. In a sense, it really depends maybe on the person in engaging with this concept. Are you cursed with the idea that you could do something but don't have the money to do it? And in a sense, that's the essence of the human condition, that we know our own fates, that we know what is possible or what will happen. Our own frailties and faults and internal issues everyone deals with every day stymies that progress or stymies that ability to achieve something or to make progress, even though we know it's possible. And that conflict is kind of the essence of being human and learning how to rest at ease with that state and accept aspects of that, but also continuing to strive and accept whatever physical or other limitations one has. Going to this idea of Apollo being this curse, there are these practical consequences that we talked about even in the previous episode, episode 4, that we had built up this infrastructure expectation that we'd be doing Apollo-like missions for decades. Very quickly, we moved away from that, but they kept the infrastructure. And this has been one of those very pragmatic but slightly boring problems that NASA has faced for decades, is that it has still the vehicle assembly building. They built that to process four Saturn V's at a time.
Pad 39A.
Yeah, right. We have all of these things. And the recent efforts to create the Space Launch System rocket, they reconfigured one of those bays, just one. So they have this excess capability that drains money for other things. that doesn't necessarily stop any of it from happening. It just kind of slows things down a little bit. It jumped so far and so fast that they didn't think in this long-term vision. And that's maybe the one drag of Apollo, that they were achieving Apollo 11. That was the goal, was Apollo 11. And the subsequent Apollos were all kind of icing on the cake from John F. Kennedy's original proclamation. But even those proved to be unsustainable, though, despite the fact that you had spent 4/5 of the entire Apollo budget by the time Apollo 11 happened. That final fifth spread out over 3 years even proved to be unsustainable. So there are these kind of practical physical consequences that we still have today. Why do we have NASA centers in, you know, Ohio and Texas and Florida and all over the place? There's all these historical reasons for those, politically supported now, that make them hard to stop. So it creates a bureaucracy that doesn't move as fast as sometimes we would like, that in the 1960s, as it was creating itself, had no institutional inertia to fight. And it's almost this consequence of being new. You see this in companies like SpaceX or Blue Origin. They're new and dynamic companies. They don't have the burdens of history to react to. They can create everything new, but that only works once, unless you burn everything down and start again, which maybe Elon Musk is crazy enough to do. But it does give upstarts an advantage temporarily. And that'll be the interesting thing as that goes forward.
I also think, and would love to hear your thoughts about another gift of Apollo, and that is all of the scientists and engineers and peripheral people, policy people like you, media people like myself, whose lives have been changed by the fact that we went to the moon, largely that we went to the moon. Now, yeah, there are plenty of other things happening in space, like you were inspired by Viking and Voyager, as was I, but something about people being out there. And I know that you had an article that maybe we'll be able to link to. I'm sure you're planning to direct people to, that talks about this human spaceflight versus robotic. I shouldn't even use the word versus, but all of those engineers continuing today, so many of those young people who, like you, were too young to directly remember Apollo, but are captured by the magic of it and want to be part of that. That may be the biggest gift of all.
This is why I call you one of the most positive people I know, Matt. You have a good outlook on this. But you're right. I mean, for all of the technology that humanity is rapidly acclimating to, it almost maybe ironically improves or makes more precious human engaged systems or a system where a human is deeply a part of it. We are still at our heart, or maybe more accurately in our brainstem, primates. We evolved in this very intense social, small social groups, right? Our brains are acutely attuned to understand social hierarchies and social graces and mores and fairness and so forth. All that comes from small primate groups. So there's something about the idea of sending a fellow primate, particularly a human one, out into space, a ham, you know, maybe wasn't as exciting. Sending a fellow human to do something has a certain emotional resonance that robotics are impossible to carry forward, for the reasons that it's kind of tickling these ancient evolutionary pathways, I think. Obviously, yes, it's harder to send humans. It's more dangerous. There's that risk. But I think it's easier for our brains to map our own experience onto the perceived experience of someone else, rather than a non-anthropomorphized hunk of metal, or even an anthropomorphized hunk of metal. It really gets into this deeper idea of a shared experience, which ultimately I think Apollo was. And I think one of the great gifts of Apollo was the shared experience of witnessing it as it happened, even though that experience itself wasn't strong enough to continue the progress that it promised.
I couldn't agree more. You'll find no argument from me. I hope that this will always be something that we humans, we primates, find important, that we ourselves go and see with our own eyes these sites and do what needs to be done. If we lose that sense of exploration, even if we are projecting it in the form of our robots that will someday be far more sophisticated, then I certainly think that we will have lost something of what it means to be human. I also think that for the foreseeable future, AI notwithstanding, humans are going to be able to do a lot of things a lot better. And so it may actually be worthwhile to build all the systems it's going to take to get us meat sacks out there to Mars and let us roam around and make those discoveries.
I'd like to bring up this a small list that I've made that I can toss out to you as I go through them. One of the challenges, I think, of Apollo is that it is one data point. It's the one successful data point of sending humans to another celestial body. It's the one data point of sending humans beyond low Earth orbit, even. It's very easy to extrapolate a line in any direction you want to go from one point, right? So you have to be, I think we have to be very cautious about deducing too many lessons from what, as we've discussed with Roger Lanius and John Logsdon and Emily Margulis and Asif Siddiqui, is effectively a historical aberration, an unlikely outcome of a confluence of events that hit at the right time. However, I think you can deduce some things from this one data point. So I have a few items here, Matt, and I'll read them off to you and we can address them in turn.
Yeah.
First, and this may sound very straightforward, but I think it's important to remind ourselves that going to the moon with humans is very hard. And we should not forget that. I mean, that's really something we need to internalize. Why hasn't anyone done this again? The fact that we have one data point over 50 years should tell us something. We haven't seen even a serious attempt by any other space agency beyond, well, you could argue that the Soviet Union made a serious attempt, but they gave up in 74, but no one else has tried in 45 years. That should say something, that going to the moon is not easy. I was reminded of that watching the Beresheet lander attempt to land this year, which was a novel attempt to try to do a low-cost lunar mission. It's easy to say we should accept more risk in spaceflight, but it's hard to actually suffer the consequences of high risk because that guarantees more failure. The group that made Beresheet is no longer making a Beresheet 2. They moved on. I think we should not dismiss the fact that we do have one data point that tells us something about the difficulty and expense inherent in it. There's not some magic way to do this faster, cheaper, or better, or else someone would have done it by now.
I think it's very perceptive. I think, yeah, the fact that it is just one data point, to rephrase that, tells us a lot. There are plenty of nations around the world that have some capital that they might have put into this. You could probably name 10. Everyone chose to pursue other goals. So far, we don't know of anybody else with firm plans to go back to the moon other than China. We don't know how sophisticated their plans are, but we know that they are, at least they've set it as a long-term goal. I think you make an excellent, excellent point. It's hard. Space is hard. Landing on the moon and getting back from there is far harder.
I'll tick that off then. I think we've come to agreement on point number one of Casey's list of Apollo takeaways. So number two, a kind of a companion point, we can do this if we want to. By not doing it, the implication is we don't want to, you know, to put it very crassly. It's not an impossible problem at the same time. We've demonstrated that the one time that we went in 1960s, it should be even easier now in a sense. It's less of an unknown whether we can send people into deep space and to the moon. Really, the implication is for most human spaceflight programs, in terms of deep space exploration, we're not technology limited. There's nothing magic required to send humans to Mars, for example. We just have to do it. Because it's hard, though, it just takes the time and money to do it. So, and I think that's a basic but important aspect, too. There's no insurmountable technological issues. I remember Roger Lanius talking about this. Apollo was kind of this perfect project at the time, because while the U.S. didn't know exactly how to do Apollo, it had a clear pathway to solution. It wasn't like the quote-unquote moonshot to cure cancer. There's no understood pathway that we just put enough money in one aspect of cancer research that solves and cures cancer. We actually profoundly do not understand the problem well enough in a lot of areas. And this is why the perennial argument of why go into space when we have problems on Earth? Well, problems on Earth are inherently social and human and cultural and national and political problems, which inherently don't have obvious or clear or easy answers, or else we would have solved them by now, almost by definition. And not only that, we don't even understand the contours of the problem enough to understand where to put the resources and when to guarantee a solution. Human spaceflight and spaceflight in general, up to a certain point, I believe represents the opposite, that we can put targeted investment, targeted effort, and the solutions are there waiting for us, but require a certain amount of activation energy, if you will, to achieve them.
Point number two, also well made and accepted. I would only add that, yeah, it's a decision, and we have clearly decided at least not to move quickly. I suspect, though, that we live in the gray area, and that perhaps over the last 45 years, that coin flip of go to the moon or not has come down 51 times go and 49 times nope. And we just keep flipping that coin. Maybe the odds haven't changed that much, but we certainly have progressed. We certainly have more technologies now, better rocket engines, better life support, unimaginably better computers and software for that matter, that might start to weight that coin further and further toward, sure, why wouldn't we go? We can do this pretty easily. Maybe it'll be done first by somebody developing a radical new way of getting there, whether it'll be Blue Origin or SpaceX or some startup in China.
Actually, I'm going to flip my next item because it's relevant to something you just said, which is about computers. And this is something that's been on my mind a lot. Roger Lanius talked about this. He wrote a book about this, Robots in Space, with another space historian, Howard McCurdy, that touched on this topic. And I think it's worth more thoughtful exploration than it tends to get. The cultural expectations around human spaceflight and the cultural, particularly visualization, you know, the romantic era of human spaceflight in the early 20th century, moving into the middle 20th century, that formed when computers and automation were effectively non-existent, or very dumb, I guess would be another way to put it. You required, as a consequence, you had to have a person in the loop to run the machine, because you could create a machine, but it wasn't capable of taking care of itself. It wasn't capable of piloting itself. It wasn't capable of much of anything beyond the most basic of computational functions. So you had to have a person. So that's why all of these early concepts of spaceflight, they just assumed a human in the loop because there was no other way to conceive of it. Even like Arthur C. Clarke stories and science fiction stories, you'd have these space stations that needed to be human tended to like point the telescopes at a certain point or to make sure the robots were working functionally. Particularly a good example would be the military and how they saw space as a so-called high ground early on.
The orbiting laboratory that was going to be tended by Gemini, which was really just a military reconnaissance satellite with giant telescopes that had to be run by humans because when they designed it, there was no way they could imagine computers doing the job.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to bring up, the manned orbiting laboratory, the MOL, which wasn't canceled until 1969. Is that the very, yeah. Right when Apollo happened. You can look at a good example, the militarization of space as it's progressed, once the technology, the automation got to a good enough point, humans were completely removed from the system in that sense, or from being in space at least. You had a few military astronauts in the shuttle era, but those were phased out by the late 80s. That tells you something. And I think culturally, our expectations for spaceflight involve humans tends to be, I think, a somewhat remnant of an earlier era where computers didn't functionally exist, and so you had to have that person. And then, of course, for that connecting emotional romantic aspect, it makes sense. But it really changes ultimately from a pragmatic position of why do we send humans into space and what are we trying to do there? And it's moved from, well, of course, they just have to be there to like pull the levers and hit the buttons and flip the switches, into we need to find a bigger, grander purpose of having humans there beyond running the show.
I think frequently of comparing the interior of the Apollo command module with switches and knobs and levers everywhere you look to the control panel of the Crew Dragon capsule from SpaceX, which is this simple, elegant, long touchscreen that swings down in front of the pilot. And I'll put that in quotes because clearly the Dragon capsule can reach the International Space Station and come home perfectly fine without any humans at the controls, at least in the capsule. Well, I guess we should acknowledge that the Soviets were doing that long before, but it is really a revolution. I do think that it presages this time when the machine will be more and more our partner on missions like this, and we can hope that they behave less like HAL 9000 and more like Alexa.
Well, the trick with HAL was just don't make him lie, I think.
Yeah, and don't give him an impossible situation that might have made a human nuts as well.
And I think let's also mention, for example, the Curiosity rover. Obviously, they tell it broadly what to do every day, but it navigates on its own. They've upgraded software so that its ChemCam laser can decide where to point what looks interesting and to zap and collect samples on its own. Self-lands on Mars, obviously, because it has to. This development in computational, it's not just computational capability, but the key word you mentioned was AI, or even more machine learning and deep learning, where you can create software that finds and understands, or not necessarily understands, but seeks out novel inputs and returns that for us. We'll do more of that discovery, and that spontaneity provided by the human brain, while probably superior for a long time, will be slowly supplanted, at least robotically or closely matched by it, as computational capability continues to increase and the software and AI software and deep learning software continues to advance. That really forces us to think about why we send people. For Apollo, just to bring it back to why Apollo happened, not only were people kind of assumed to be required to go to the moon and come back, but it was the fact that it was difficult was the point, right? Turned out to be a statement. And that actually brings me into my next point, which is that you cannot separate the political system from human spaceflight. And I believe that has been true for basically up to this point in the space age, for the first 70 years of the space age or 60 years of the space age, that the politics and the advances made by humans in space are inseparable.
I would extend it. I would extend it backward to the beginning of civilization.
No, please go on.
In each culture that has arisen from the times of Mesopotamia, I have no doubt but that politics and policymaking determined in large part the success or failure of those civilizations. There were those times when other civilizations gave up periods of glorious exploration and expansion in China, in Portugal, and elsewhere. It led to, if not the downfall of those societies, certainly the loss of leadership that they had enjoyed when they had been pushing the envelope. But I'm sure that there were sensible voices, leaders with lots of public support, who said that this was not sustainable. And so I think this is just a continuation of a challenge that we have faced in human society from the beginning.
Yeah, and to me, human spaceflight is an even more extreme version of that, because as it has progressed so far, we don't even have the economic or resource motivations yet to continue that investment. Like, why did we have the European colonization of the Western Americas? Well, there was money to be made, essentially.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
space has so far not proven that. The real politics of space, or what I just mentioned, right? It's an expression of larger national capability, which ebbs and flows with the current broader global politics at the time. So it, kind of the sub points, I think, beyond the fact that, and I'm really emphasizing, I think, human spaceflight here because of its complexity and cost, and also its visual nature and of just the overall awareness of, we were all the reasons we were talking about why people connect with human spaceflight. As a consequence of that statement, I think the what you see as the amount of investment that nations put into human spaceflight programs are commensurate with their perceived relevance to national, basically national security, but also just national standing.
Yeah, and so an ability to make some profit.
Yeah, well, yeah. And so it's relevance, let's say broadly relevant. So after Apollo made its goal, it achieved its statement of outdoing the Soviet Union, the money disappeared. The rationale evaporated with Armstrong's first steps on the moon, or actually probably really with his first footsteps on the Hornet after he got back. And so the money fell again. That we saw increases for things like International Space Station because human spaceflight became relevant again in the collapse of this, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, to try to engage the new Russian Federation, and you know, became a much more political, it solved the political problem again. We now face an issue where we have an administration directing humans back to the moon, but it doesn't solve a political problem. It actually creates political problems in terms of how they get the funding for it. I think human spaceflight as designed or as executed in the last 60 years is very susceptible to this. And almost like another corollary to this would be at the end of Apollo, when the Nixon White House was thinking about what to do with the human spaceflight program, some people briefly discussed, well, why don't just stop? You know, why not? If we don't want to spend the money, why even send people into space? Nixon did not want to be the president. In fact, no president wants to be the president of a space program that ends human spaceflight altogether.
Yes.
The political nature of that, too. So it kind of goes back to this idea that, that human spaceflight is a political endeavor that receives investment commensurate to its relevance to the politics at the time.
Yes. And I think that statement could be enshrined somewhere in NASA headquarters, perhaps. I absolutely agree. But isn't it great that space exploration and even human space exploration, at least at this moment and for the last more than 50 years, is a political necessity? It cannot be entirely canceled without a terrible negative reflection on the person who might cancel it, who might express
Absolutely.
That. And I see that as a great gift.
Yes. And it's almost like once you walked through that door, it closes behind you.
Hmm.
You can't go back politically for a self-perceived great nation. Russia, despite its economic troubles throughout the 1990s, continued and committed to human spaceflight. You've had Russian cosmonauts for as long as you've had slightly longer than American astronauts. That capability is important to the program, despite that it's somewhat cash-strapped for other areas. Yes, I think it is. It's a wonderful, in a sense, it's a security for spaceflight at a certain level. At the same time, it kind of makes you wonder, if things go real bad in a nation, how long will human spaceflight stay a priority over any other aspect of spaceflight? It's probably for the long time. I think that's a nice way of thinking about it. It's in a sense, it's a protective political layer because no one wants to be a politician who ends something that looks good and sounds that good and represents, in a sense, the so-called maybe vibrancy of a national engineering, scientific, and organizational commitment.
Yeah, and I would add that though we are not there yet, take it as a statement of faith on my part or my unstoppable optimism, but my unshakable belief that there is going to be a lot of money made out there, beginning in low Earth orbit, when we find the killer app for microgravity, and then beyond. I think it's inevitable. It will happen. And yet I can't point to any particular technological advance or resource that is going to make it happen. I just look at human history and how we have found a way to make even the most unlikely expansion or bit of exploration pay off. I suspect that that's going to happen in space as well. But it is a statement of faith.
It brings me to my final point that I think we can take away from Apollo. It's related to this. Apollo and the way that it succeeded, basically a massive top-down, highly structured, hierarchical government effort, cost a decent amount of money, took a lot of people, but it succeeded. That is may not be the only way to send humans into space, but it is so far the only successful way that has ever been demonstrated. We feel now, I think, that we're on the cusp of a potential change in spaceflight with the rise of not just new nations participating, but new companies and capabilities, potentially new funding sources. But the only successful data point we've ever had is the so-called old way of doing business. When we think about the future, I think it's important that we hedge our expectations for unproven ways of doing things, because if they were so successful, they would have been done by now. And they're, by definition, I think, a risk, but one worth taking. But if you want something to guarantee success, we have a model for it. And that's, I think we shouldn't be dismissing that as it has been practiced over the last 60 years.
Hear, hear. And may we soon, with any luck in our lifetimes, have a plethora of additional data points that will take us eventually, probably beyond my lifetime, to that future that I first read about when I read my first Robert Heinlein novel, Have Spacesuit, Will Travel, of humanity and its creations ubiquitous, across the solar system. That's still the future I'm waiting for, and I hope we are taking small steps toward that every day.
Going back to Kennedy's original speech, well, not the original speech, but a speech at Rice University, is about Apollo being, or space being, the best way to organize our measures and abilities. That is, I think, a really longstanding truth, that a good way to direct our energies as a species is by organizing around the difficult challenge of exploring space, to touch on all those things that you just mentioned, as opposed to going to war with each other or finding ways to be miserable or succumbing to inward-looking social media posts about, you know, that flatters your own ego and the egos of others, but to literally look up and out and to take in the universe around us for what it is, to learn how to work in that reality and not to deny its existence, but to learn how to solve the problems that it throws at us, seems to me to be a very healthy input into our little primate brains. And organizing around that for peaceful, cooperative exploration to extend ourselves out into the cosmos, that I think remains one of the most inspiring and long-term hopeful visions I think that we have. Obviously, I think Apollo is a gift that even despite how something comes to be, particularly in any political system, it has to address immediate practical problems or else it just won't really happen. Despite how it comes to be, it still touched this deep aspect of ourselves and our experience. And again, this is someone else who wrote this, but really resonated with me, but that we remember as a kind of cultural consciousness, usually tragedies. Where were you when Kennedy died? Where were you when Martin Luther King was shot? Or in 9/11, right? We all remember, if you were alive then, the moment you learned about that. Apollo is one of the vanishingly few moments that if you were alive for it, everyone remembers vividly. And it was a happy thing. It was a triumph. Hmm. Mm-hmm. And those are not to be dismissed as a statement of human capability and human success, but also opportunities for brief unification of the human experience around the world. So if nothing else, Apollo has gifted us that.
To be embraced. One would hope that more people will come to see space exploration, including human space exploration, as something that we do not in spite of our other challenges, but because of our other challenges.
Wonderful way to put that, Matt. Matt, it was fun talking to you, thinking about this. Let's hope that we'll be doing this on the 50th anniversary of Artemis landing in the future, where we all have age-defying medicine, let's say.
Bring on the singularity.
I'll take it.
I look forward to it. I'll put it on the calendar, Casey, for 50 years from today.
Wonderful, Matt. Thank you so much for talking through these issues with me and for making the show a possibility. It was a lot of fun to put together, and I want to thank everyone who's listening to this. Thank you for listening. This is a joy to do, and I hope to do more special shows like this in the future.
The Political History of Apollo was edited by Matt Kaplan and hosted by me, Casey Dreyer. It is a production of the Planetary Society, a nonprofit organization dedicated to space science and exploration. Anyone can be a member, so please consider joining the Planetary Society at planetary.org/membership. Your membership enables us to create projects like this podcast, as well as pursue our ongoing work in space advocacy, education, and technology. If you are already a member, thank you. Seriously, thank you. I want to also thank all of the guests on this show for their time and expertise, and to the band Wax Fang for the use of their song. If you enjoyed this show, please review it and share it with your friends. You might also like to check out our weekly podcast, Planetary Radio, and our monthly podcast, Planetary Radio Space Policy Edition. You can find both of them on all major podcast platforms and on planetary.org/radio.